This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wally Stroyenko was the first African to receive the Nobel Prize for Literature. That was in 1986. The African-American writer and professor Henry Louis Gates said it was a miracle that Stroyenko was alive to get this prize. Stroyenko is an outspoken critic of military rule in his country, Nigeria, and has been imprisoned for his views. This week, Stroyenko is in the U.S., warning that the future of democracy in Nigeria is in jeopardy. In June, the first elections in 10 years were held, but the elections were annulled by President Babangida, the general who took over in a 1985 military coup. The general has promised that new elections will be held, and Nigeria will return to civilian rule by August 27th. He first promised a swift return to civilian rule back in 1986. There have been violent protests against the government's decision to void the election. I asked Stroyenko what it feels like to have an election annulled.
Well, it's a very weird feeling of complete unreality. It's as if there has been a game. Both sides have played the best they can. One side wins, of course. The other loses. At the end of the match, they shake hands. Then the referee comes along and says, no, that match is null and void because the goalposts should not have been where they were to start with. It's the most bizarre kind of experience. Now, if the annulment had come about as a result of protestations, and this has happened before, local government or something like that, proven malfeasance and so on, there would have been no problem. But this was an election which was declared by international monitors, by civil rights organizations who were monitoring the elections, by even government parastatals which were set up for this kind of purpose. The Center for Democratic Studies, another organization called MAMSA, all of them gave exemplary pass marks to the election. And then along comes the referee and says, no, the elections did not take place.
Yeah, the president has said he'll hand over power to civilian rule on August 27th. Do you think that's going to happen?
The president has said so many things. He's sworn so many things, crossed my heart, and so on and so forth. He's sworn things on his honor, and he's gone back on his word. Nobody trusts the word of President Babangida anymore.
What are your fears of what might happen in the near future in your country?
Well, to use your favorite expression here, there is a worst-case scenario, and there is a more acceptable, agonizing scenario. All I know, what I believe, is that Babangida will leave that office. He will leave that office willingly or unwillingly. The mood of the nation is such that it cannot, the nation will not tolerate the prolongation of military rule. People want the military out of their lives, permanently, out of their political lives, that is. Now, looking at the irreconcilability of the positions, there is a possibility. There is a possibility of some kind of civil war at a certain level. Now, that's the worst possible scenario. I believe that this will not come about. What may come about is that we will have, in effect, a Zairean scenario whereby you have two governments in that country. And then people, both inside and international communities outside, will have to choose which one they recognize as the legitimate government of the people of Nigeria.
You've used the expression the humiliation of tyranny. Let me ask you to expand on that.
Yes, well, here is one typical example. Humiliation comes about as a result of impotence. You know, a situation which is pernicious, which is wrong, which is exploitative, and you're left with a feeling of impotence, nothing you can do about it, at least nothing that will not cost the victims far more than it will cost the aggressors. In other words, the equation is totally unbalanced. Now, in this particular instance, here is a very tiny cabal. And when I say a tiny cabal, I mean really tiny. It's even a minority part of the military, but one which controls certain forces. And it is ramming its will down the throats of the Nigerian peoples. You have a tyranny which has set rules for an election, rules and procedures which were grudgingly, very grudgingly accepted by the populace simply because they felt, well, this may be the last sacrifice to get these unwanted supervisors of their lives out of the way. And then the rules are changed and changed again. Politicians or contestants who once were banned, detained, are undetained and then let loose to contest, after which they are banned again. New rules are made in the middle of the game, such as, for instance, one of the latest, in order to get rid of two unwanted candidates, suddenly new rules were made which made it impossible for any contestant to be accepted if he's under 50 years of age. Now, what could be more ridiculous, more insulting than that to a people's intelligence? The president of this country is under 50, to the best of my knowledge, and what has age got to do with it on that level anyway? The other one is disqualified on the grounds that he was not up to a year in the party. Nobody can contest for this position if he's less than 1 year old in the party. And this power base forgets, in fact, that the electoral lists had been totally cancelled and renewed, so that nobody in the party is 1 year old legally. Now, it is stupidities like that, you know, irrationalities, very tortuous and odious manipulation of peoples, which are presented to a very intelligent and sophisticated public as something desirable on behalf of a democratic structure. Now, that all this constitute the kind of humiliation which is experienced today by the average Nigerian.
Your country, Nigeria, gained its independence from England in 1960. What were your ideals then?
You ask a very chastening question there. It was one of very high optimism. I was a student in England just on the eve of independence, and I could not wait to get back and contribute to making a showcase, if you like, of Nigeria on the African continent. Of course, I was not unaware of the difficulties. I was not unaware of the fact that the first generation post-colonial politicians who held the reins of power had certain notions which were not compatible with the, shall we say, the highest ideals of nation builders. Many of them clearly felt that they were there just to step into the shoes of the departing colonial masters, with all the privileges, with all the power sense, you know, the dominating kind of attitude. We were aware of that, but we were convinced, my generation at least, were convinced that we had enough will, enough capability, enough understanding of the situation to really transform that nation in a very short while.
Was it surprising to you that Nigerians could be corrupt and power-hungry oppressors of their own people?
Well, the issue of corruption is not one which I find myself unduly obsessed with, because I find corruption everywhere. As corruption in the Soviet Union, if we look at Italy today, it looks as if that is one showcase of corruption for the whole world. American society also has its corrupt practices and so on. But the problem with Nigeria's own brand of corruption is that it does not produce. In other words, corruption appears to be the industry rather than it's been an unfortunate and reprehensible offspin of genuine productive efforts. And that is why I think Nigeria is very backward today.
Do you blame the problems that Nigeria and some other African countries have been having on the path toward democracy? Do you blame that on the aftermath of colonialism or just on the more rotten part of human nature?
A little bit of both. And also, don't let us forget that the Western world, and indeed the Eastern world, the former Eastern world, very much favored the strong man in Africa. Then their idea was that since they were removing their presence, they could operate, they could relate better commercially, politically, even socially, with a strong man in charge. That's the expression, the strong man of Nicaragua, the strong man of Zaire, the strong man of Ghana. That kind of expression, which just inflated the ego of these little petty tyrants who felt that since their very presence, their individual presence, was so much in demand, was so congenial to the wishes and the plans of their former colonial masters or their new European allies, that their path of absolute despotism was the correct one.
Wole Soyinka is my guest. He's a Nobel Prize-winning writer from Nigeria, and he's the chairman of the African Democratic League. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Wole Soyinka, Nobel Prize-winning writer and chairman of the African Democratic League. Now, I believe you were studying abroad in London at about the time of Nigerian independence. You came back to Nigeria. What part did you want to play in the life of your newly independent country?
One thing which I was certain of was that I was no politician. A political activist, yes, but politician in the sense of going into politics, running for office, no, that was not my idea of contribution. I was mostly interested in collaborating with people of my temperament, whether in the sciences, the arts, and technology, in providing a pool of expertise for the various needs of the country, and of seeing that we participated in the liberation of the African continent from colonialism.
At what point did you find yourself becoming a dissident?
Almost immediately, shortly after my return, by observing the then politicians at close quarters, I found that the niggling fears which we had students when we beheld them perform during partial independence, we found that this disease was a little bit more serious than we thought. In other words, the idea that their responsibilities were limited to simply performing as replacements of colonial masters. Mind you, there were exceptions, even within Nigeria. There were exceptions, and I considered it my duty at the time to try and ally, however indirectly, with those progressive elements within Nigeria.
What are the actions that got you into the most trouble?
Well, I'm basically a writer, as you know. That is my profession, and one feels that the dissemination of ideas, of knowledge, the contestation even of ideas, should be enough to propel a nation along progressive routes. And by that, you know, I use the word very specifically, a route which, along which one serves the people rather than oneself. And, of course, as time went on, I found that writing the word was no longer enough for certain specific situations. And so during the Biafran War, for instance, I'd already tasted a little bit of prison hospitality before then, but during the Biafran War in particular, when I was convinced that we were being plunged into a war which was unjust, unnecessary, and totally avoidable, I visited at great risk, the enclave of Biafra, to meet Ojukwu, the then rebel leader, the leader of the ceded nation of Biafra. And of course, on return, I was arrested, interrogated, and ended up serving 2 years and 3-4 months in prison, most of it in solitary confinement. So I think that was a single action that created the most problem for me.
You've written that solitary confinement begets strange monsters. What monsters came to you when you were locked up by yourself?
Ooh, rather frightening ones. Hallucinations, as a result of hallucinations, a period when you were afraid that you could not be absolutely accurate about what constituted a reality. In other words, because you're alone and you cannot sort of test your ideas on other people, you cannot share certain very strange experiences you went through as a result of solitude. you began to question even what is obviously reality. Now, that was a phase which you know, lasted a month or two, but I managed to transcend that phase and slaughter the monsters.
Were there specific things that most confused you about what was real and what was not?
Shapes, mostly. The self-transformation of shapes, shadows, especially in the evening, just this dusk fell, and the light played tricks on leaves and trees and walls, even on the grill through which the rainwater, flowed, and so on. The impact of certain experiences, like a row of chained feet dragging themselves slowly across those tiny grills, which I mentioned earlier. The impact of the silences that accompanied executions, and so on and so forth. These were the things which contributed, I think, to a temporary loss of an assured grasp on reality.
How much light was there in your cell?
Oh, during the day there was plenty of light, and during the day I was released from my cell, and I could sit in the corridor there within the compound. At night, of course, there was no light, but there was a bulb in the corridor which I succeeded in tricking towards the grill above my door, so I could use some of the light in the evening, which is the best time to scribble with my improvised paper, pen, ink, things like that.
What did you do to improvise paper?
Well, toilet paper was always there, and of course the...
It's really hard to write on toilet paper because it's so thin.
The kind of toilet paper they serve you in prison,
I guess that's true.
can take any kind of a quill.
And you had a pen?
I made pen. I made
What'd you make
ink.
Them out of?
I made pens out of bones, which occasionally came with pieces of meat. I made pens even out of some bones and metals which I dug up from the earth around the cell. Once even a crow was kind enough. It was a very, very, very weird moment, because the compound was open to the skies, high walls, and so on. And a quill flew over and dropped, a crow flew over and dropped a quill, literally at my feet. I even wrote a poem to it. It was such a,
do you remember
such
the
a strange
poem?
Moment. I think I entitled it Crow Quill, but I cannot remember the lines.
I think you went on hunger strikes more than once while you were in prison. What did you hope to achieve by that?
Well, I was protesting. First of all, at the beginning, I went on hunger strike because I was not being brought to trial, and I wanted, as they say, my day in court. I wanted to, use that opportunity to denounce what is going on. Eventually, I gave that up, or was made to give it up. Then the second time, which was more serious, this was in Kaduna Prison when I was in solitary confinement. And I think I sort of came to a desperate conclusion that if I didn't do something desperate, my mind might not survive intact. That really was the motivation for the second bout of hunger strike, which really went very, very far.
So you thought the discipline of the hunger strike would help keep your mind intact?
That helped, and also I felt that if I was wasting away, the prison authorities would realize that they were confronted with a dangerous situation and would have to do something.
Did they?
Well, whether that was what worked, or it worked in combination with protestations outside and letters of inquiries from Amnesty International and human rights bodies all over the world and even some governments, I don't know. But suddenly, I was allowed to have books. A book would be brought from time to time, and when I finished with it, it would be taken away. And that was a great boost to my exercises for keeping sane. It boosted my toilet paper material because I was now able to write between the lines, and I still have those volumes where with my scribbles between the lines.
So the books also became your writing tablets.
That is correct.
Yes. When you look back on what you wrote while you were in prison, how does it read to you? Does it hold up?
Yes, some of it did, and in fact, I made an astonishing discovery, which will be probably useful for those who study the psychology of creativity. When I came out, I don't know whether that's experience of most people, most prisoners. The last thing I wanted to think about was that prison experience and whatever happened in there. For me, it was invalid. It was 2 years and some months written off my life. I refused to accept that anybody should benefit, should be able to produce anything at all from prison. And so when I began writing Ake, The Years of Childhood, later, I did not remember that I had actually begun writing that book in prison. And it was a revelation years after the book was published to, you know, chance on those chaplets of mine, the books, and find that I had begun writing Ake in there. And that, in fact, there were huge, you know, there were chunks of paragraphs which seemed to have been, it's almost as if I'd copied them from the original draft. So that's interesting.
It really is. It really is.
I found it very curious.
The mind really plays tricks too, mm-hmm. doesn't it?
Yes, yes. And there's some other poems which I wrote in prison. For instance, I smuggled out some poems while I was in prison, and these were published while I was still in there.
Wale Soyinka is the winner of the 1986 Nobel Prize for Literature and the chair of the African Democratic League. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More with Soyinka in the second part of our show. This is Fresh Air. Wale Soyinka's writing won him a Nobel Prize for Literature in 1986. Nearly 20 years before that, his criticisms of his government got him about 2 years in solitary confinement. He wrote about his imprisonment in his book The Man Died. His memoir Ake is about the Yoruba village he grew up in. He's also the author of many plays and poems. Soyinka was born in 1934 in Nigeria, when it was a colony of England. In the mid-50s, he went to England to study and returned to Nigeria in 1960, the year of its independence. He's in the United States this week. Yesterday, he testified before Congress about the political crisis in his country, where the June elections were annulled by the president. Soyinka is the chair of the African Democratic League. I asked him if the Nobel Prize protected him and made it easier to speak out in Nigeria without the fear of being punished.
Well, it certainly gave me some enhanced status vis-a-vis governance. But I have to say that although it restrained governments somewhat, it did not totally diminish one's vulnerability. If anything, it changed the quality of one's vulnerability. For instance, we had a very fascistic regime called, in fact, before this one, we had a civilian regime, which was under Shagari. And that regime became increasingly brutal and fascistic. And I had to flee the country at one stage. I was actually literally bundled onto the plane through the underground channel by the very people who had been sent to eliminate me. It was a very curious business. But that was, of course, was before the Nobel. I narrate it just to say that even before the Nobel, I had a certain level of protection. But of course, this became more serious after, you know, as time went on.
This time when you were bundled and put on the plane, was that when you went into exile?
Yes, that's when I went into exile.
What did you think made it okay for you to return? When did you return?
Well, I think I returned out of annoyance about 2 months later. I think it was just the notion of me being forced into yet another exile by a regime which I so totally despised. And so I came back, taking extra precautions and so on and so forth.
What year was it?
Let me go back. That's 1983. Mm-hmm. 83. And I came back because I was convinced that the opposition forces were now sufficiently well geared up to operate on such a level that I could participate. And for me, that was okay. Being a sitting duck is what I've never been able to accept. but if things are happening in which one can be a part, then that's no problem at all. You know, one can accept the risks, you know, in those circumstances. And sure enough, the predicted insurrection began, and eventually Buhari came in with his military coup and pushed them out. And of course, it turned just, if anything, even more brutal than Shagari's regime.
It must be awfully frustrating to just have one military dictator replaced by another.
It is frustrating. It is frustrating and boring. And very boring. Because they even when they begin well, as Babangida did, it's no question at all that he came on the wave of popular acclaim. Buhari had been so despotic, so brutal, so intolerant. I mean, he'd even pronounced any discussion of return to civilian rule as illegal and unacceptable and punishable. So the papers could not even discuss dates for return to civilian rule. So when Babangida came in, he was accepted. He made beautiful pronouncements about respect for human rights. He also set a date. He set a date for return to civilian rule. He took one or two economic steps which were quite brave and, you know, courageous and sensible. And then gradually, like the rest of them, he began to go seriously wrong, became more repressive, and it became evident that he was seeking to perpetuate himself. In other words, there came a stage where there was no difference between the person, his predecessor, who said, don't so much as discuss a return to democratic rule. This one encourage everybody not only to discuss but to participate in an elaborate charade, you know, parallel to all this billion-dollar expensive, extravagant scenario for return to civilian rule with local government elections, state elections, House of Assembly, etc., etc. He had actually put in place a parallel scheme for staying permanently in power. A scheme which is constantly undermining the public motions towards democracy. I don't know which one is more disgusting,
yeah.
Buhari's or Babangida's.
My guest is Wole Soyinka, Nobel laureate and chair of the African Democratic League. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Wole Soyinka, the Nobel Prize-winning writer and also the chairman of the African Democratic League. When you were growing up in Nigeria, your father was headmaster for a school that was set up by the British colonial government.
Missionaries, as a matter of fact.
The missionaries?
Yes.
Were there conflicts in your family between Western-style education and Yoruba tradition?
Not really, because even though, on the one hand, the attitude of my parents, especially my mother, they were Christians and very devout Christians, and my mother was a particularly devout Christian. In fact, I nicknamed her the Wild Christian. And so she tended to look down on what she called pagan practices, pagan religions, and so on and so forth. But my father was he had a more eclectic mind, where he was very argumentative and was curious. He had great intellectual curiosity and would want to talk about these things which were called pagan and unchristian anyway. He didn't sort of distance himself from them or pull up the hem of his trousers in that sense.
You wrote in your book about growing up that your mother was often worried about your inwardness. Was that because you read a lot?
Yes, I read a lot, and I rather liked my own company a lot more than is considered healthy in Yoruba traditional society. A child is not supposed to wander off into the woods and stay by himself in, you know, in groves and so on, unless, of course, he was a what we call abami or abamiyomo.
What does that mean?
Which this means that the child might possibly have companions in the other world. It's a theme which has appeared in some poems of mine and which has been beautifully elaborated in the work of this young writer, Ben Okri, The Famished Road. You know, Yoruba believe in different levels of existence, the world of the living, the world of the ancestor, and the world of the unborn. And a certain kind of child is supposed to continue to retain his or her links with the world of the unborn, those waiting to be born. So when a family, traditional family, sees a child who seems to be a little bit introverted or, you know, solitary in conduct, efforts are made really to pull him out of that, shake him up, and throw him among siblings of a different temperament, to bring him back, to bring him down to earth, that sort of thing.
Now, you studied in England. You went to college in England.
Yes.
And I wonder how you felt going to study at the headquarters of the colonial powers.
Oh, no, no qualms at all. I couldn't wait to get away from home into the big, wide world, wherever it happened to be. In fact, at one time, I was more interested in coming to the United States. I knew there were more blacks here. From all reports from those who'd studied there, the United States had a kind of exotic attraction which the United Kingdom didn't have. The United Kingdom was, you know, a matter of course. Former colonial master, people went there as a matter of course. In the case of the States, it was something of the forbidden fruit there. And that's really where I wanted to come. But England was just as good, since it was outside Nigeria. And I was excited, and I think I lived a very noisy existence as a student there. I was very exploratory.
How much of Yoruba tradition do you feel that you've kept in your life?
Oh, lots. And I think it's... critics acknowledge that my works are permeated through and through with many, many aspects of Yoruba culture. And my lifestyle at home, especially, is a constant mixture of both the of Western culture and Yoruba culture.
And you're comfortable with a mixture? You don't feel you have to be one thing or the other?
Oh, very, very comfortable. I like comfortable European shoes, and I like Yoruba danseke, or whatever it's called in this country, and I like being... I like going to the... wandering through markets and going through the bush and hunting with my fellow Yoruba hunters. And I feel absolutely comfortable, you know, no contradiction internally at all.
And you're comfortable, too, with the combination in your life of being a writer and, you know, often writing fiction and your role as a political activist.
Now, that one, I'm not very sure I always feel comfortable with. There are many, many times, as now, that I feel very highly resentful. I feel a crisis has been imposed on me and others, which is avoidable, which is unnecessary, which is totally disrupted, for instance, you know, to be mundane and specific, disrupted my plans for this year, my creative plans for this year. A crisis which has been born out of the egomania of a bunch of power-drunk people, you know, who should just get out of the way. No, I don't always feel comfortable. Accept it, but resentment is the larger part of my feeling.
What would you like to see the United States do in relationship to the crisis in your country now?
Yes, I'd like to see embargoes inflicted on the country. You know, I'd like to see the revenue from petroleum products, which is our main product, put into an escrow account. I'd like to see an arms embargo, spare parts being withheld. I'd like to see the United States and other outside countries take a very positive step in isolating Nigeria in every possible way, as long as this military junta clings to power.
Will you be in danger when you go back to Nigeria?
Oh, it's always an occupational risk.
So you might be?
Yes, I expect so. It'll govern, that recognition will govern my movements. I mean, I'm I'm not foolhardy. I'm very practical.
And what does that mean? You know where not to go?
Or? I know where not to go. I know when to go in. I know, you know, it's kind of complex kind of existence, but one has to be hard-headed. For instance, the president-elect, Moshood Abiola, was forced to flee the country only yesterday. He's on his way to the States right now. We'd always known that his life was in danger and strongly recommended a series of security precautions and so on and so forth. But he'd stayed very valiantly right in the middle of everything. But two nights ago, he found that he was compelled to leave, at least for a short while.
Is there violence against dissidents now in Nigeria? Are many dissidents being imprisoned?
Yes. We have several pro-democracy activists in detention. The president of the Association for Nigerian Authors, Ken Saro-Wiwa, is in prison and probably be charged also for treason under a newly made decree, a newly passed decree, which virtually makes thinking visibly an act of treason if it can be proved that your process of thought inclined in a particular direction. It's one of the most sweeping and most outrageous decrees ever passed. The government made up its mind a long time ago that it was going to extend its stay indefinitely and began a systematic repression, not only of dissident voices, but of potential dissident voices. So we're really living in perilous times. There's no question at all about that.
Well, I wish you very good luck.
Thank you very much.
Wale Soyinka is a Nobel laureate and chair of the African Democratic League. This is Fresh Air.